Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The leader picked to investigate the 2020 election has a strong message for clerks who don't participate with his investigation. And the battle over drawing new maps in Wisconsin is heating up. Plus, the state's top education official delivers her first speech about the future of education as schools continue their battle against COVID-19. All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for September 24th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Well, J.R. Ross, the redistricting battle is well underway, even before the legislature has drawn any maps, let alone vote on it. We had some updates in the state and federal court. Let's first start with the state Supreme Court, which the 4-3 conservative majority agreed to accept the redistricting case at the request of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Now, they didn't really explain their rationale for taking the case, but conservative Justice Rebecca Bradley wrote in a concurring opinion that the court taking the case sends a message to the federal court that the justices are prepared to wade the dispute.
Mm-hmm.
So first, let's start with state Supreme Court, then we'll move on to the federal court and so their kind of updates with the
almost need a flow chart right now, Emily, for like keep track of what's going on.
Yeah.
So there's a tension here between the two courts because which one was going to go first and who would draw the map. Who draws the map is very important. Now, let's say in theory, Republican lawmakers and Governor Evers could reach an agreement on a map and they could draw it themselves. In reality, it's not going to happen.
Very unlikely.
It's very different for a federal court when it draws the map versus when it reviews a map. And this is why this is important. The federal court had a hearing on Tuesday and said, we're ready to go. We have a timeline we want to meet because the Elections Commission wants a map in place by March 1st. To do that, we want to go ahead and have this trial end of January. There's no indication from the Capitol, the state Capitol, they're ready to go. The next day, the state Supreme Court says, we are queued up to go. Now, what's interesting is the conservative majority basically just said, we've always said these belong in state courts, and that's about it. Don't really get into like the rationale of why they took it. Bradley sent some signals in her concurring opinion, which it's worth noting concurring opinions mean it's just, I agree with the majority, but here's my rationale. Nobody else joined Rebecca Bradley in her rationale. So she's kind of a lone wolf on this one. But she said, such a message to the court that we're ready to go, which should push the court, federal court aside and have it stay in state court. Why is that important? Republicans feel like they would get a better map from a Republican or conservative majority of the state Supreme Court than a federal court because it's a three-judge panel. The three-judge panel had two Obama appointees and one Trump appointee. They haven't had much success getting that three-judge panel to like push this case aside yet, so they felt like the state Supreme Court's a better place for us. Now, the question is, who's going to blink? So the federal court isn't bound to step aside because the state Supreme Court took this case. But you can imagine it's not really a tenable position to have two different maps out there, right? And whose map would be in place? So the theory is that the federal court may bow to the state Supreme Court, say, okay, you guys go ahead. We already have a filing now in the federal court from the plaintiffs in the state Supreme Court case. Again, the flow chart would help. But the state Supreme Court, state Supreme Court plaintiffs, they are an intervener in the federal case. They filed a motion on Thursday saying, by the way, guys, the Supreme Court is now ready to act. We want you to stay your proceedings, period. The GOP-led state legislature filed a notice with the federal court saying, you guys should just dismiss this case, period. Now, they didn't really like make an argument, just said, the state court is taking this, you should dismiss this, period. The federal court has said, we'll give you guys October 1st to respond to this and decide where to go from there. The state Supreme Court, meanwhile, has set a deadline in early October to say, okay, who wants to weigh in? And you should answer this question, which is, when do we need a map in place?
That's going to be my next question.
So the Elections Commission has said March 1st, because April 15th is the first day you can circulate nomination papers. It's 45 days, essentially, to put those maps in place to say, okay, you candidates live in this district, and you voters live in this district, therefore you candidates can get signatures from these voters. Because in theory, you don't have a map, you can't go through your papers because you don't know who to ask for a signature, right? Your lines can move dramatically. Now, go back years ago. In 2002, for example, we didn't get a map until I think it was June, something like that. So there's a much more compressed window to circulate nomination papers. The difference was that primary back then was in September. It's moved up a full month to August. So June wouldn't work because June 1st is the filing deadline. Republicans have argued that the 45 days the commission wants is too much. They don't need that much time to get this thing in place. But we'll have the courts answer the question of when do we need to have a map, and it'll help set the deadline of when they're going to need to act.
And in the meantime, there's this dueling map proposals, I guess. Mm-hmm. Governor Evers has this commission called the People's Maps that are going to draw them nonpartisan, as he swears they would be. But then you also have Speaker Voss still pushing his initiative, which is an online website where anyone could submit their own maps.
Right.
Maps, excuse me.
And so then the People's Map Commission plans to have three drafts out by the end of next week. They will then meet and have a final map that's their map that they'll submit to legislature. I don't know if it's going to get very far with Robin Voss or Devin LeMahieu, but the reality is that map was probably going to be Governor Evers' map that's going to submit to the courts and then go to draw lines. The legislature has a deadline of October 15th for their maps to be submitted. The question is, when are they going to meet to pass a map?
That's what I was just going to ask. We know they're coming back next week, but you know they're just going to be on the floor, so
yes.
Voting on, you know, I guess rushing through their legislation until the end of the year. Big question there is, when are they going to focus on maps?
What do the courts say to the legislature of, at what point can we wait no longer for you? Now, the longer, in theory, that Robin Voss and Devin LeMahieu wait, the less time the court has to act, the more maybe the court is pressured to pick a map versus drawing one of its own. Now, courts are not map drawers, okay? They have a couple options, though. In these cases, you can either hire, it's called a special master, who could be the one who draws the map. So you imagine some poor law clerk taking all these arguments and drawing a map on his or her own. Or you could have maps submitted to the court, and you can pick which one you like the best. So that's important because Robin Voss and Devin LeMahieu have written a resolution, which will be on the floor of the Assembly on Tuesday, that says the state's policy is that these maps shouldn't change a whole lot from what's in place right now. Why is that important? Democrats feel those maps are gerrymandered against them. They're not fair. If you don't change the maps dramatically, then you're...
Republicans remain in control of the state legislature.
Now, it's the policy of the state without actually Governor Evers to weigh in. He is a very important figure in the state policy. But this is a resolution that's only done by the legislature. So Democrats are kind of raising some red flags about this. The guess is that that's going to be part of the record they submit to the court, the Supreme Court, to say, hey, you should follow these principles. Now, don't forget, 10 years ago, Republicans reworked the map dramatically to account for population changes. There are a lot of districts that changed dramatically from where they were in 2002 with that map that was drawn by the courts. They are then, hey, population changes, population shifted, has to be big changes. Now they're saying, don't make big changes, keep it as it is. So consistency is not a strong point of politicians, even guessed after all these years. So now it's what's next. The resolution is going to pass on the floor. We'll go to the Supreme Court, and we see, when do they actually pass a map? What's Governor Evers do? And is there any way that the lawmakers can have a persuasion over Governor Evers of, you should sign our map versus risking what the court might do? I doubt he signs it, but that might be part of their plan of how can we pressure Governor Evers on this.
We've also doubted the governor of signing a Republican budget, and he's done it 2 years in a row. You never know.
Yeah. And, you know, in years past, congressional maps, take those apart for a second, the delegation basically drew the map. So like 10 years ago, the chief of staff for Paul Ryan, for example, basically gave Republican lawmakers, here's your map for the congressional districts. And the story I was told was that one of the leaders said, okay, I'll take it to my caucus. And he was told, no, this is your map. And what congressional members did was they basically took care of each other. You know, they had these old rules of thumb. You didn't really campaign against each other, endorse against each other. You drew maps that were pleasant for each other. Those days are gone. And I don't even know if Governor Evers got a map like that. If you can lock in a 5-3 Republican majority in the congressional delegation, which might be good for Democrats right now, right, because it could be a tough year. The 3rd district in West Wisconsin could get really Republican. You can see a 6-2 Republican majority without too many troubles. If you locked in a 5-3 map for Democrats, could Evers sign that map? Probably not. He's really locked in this People's Map Commission, having a quote-unquote fair map that comes from a nonpartisan, in his words, commission.
And the only risk going with the state Supreme Court is always this lingering judge, Justice Brian Hagedorn, which way is he going to vote? He sided with liberal justices on the court before. So, also, let's move on to another Gableman update in the Republicans' investigation into the 2020 presidential election. It was this very unusual video. Yes. One of the first times, I know, for us TV folks, seeing Gableman talk about his investigation. Before we get into the weeds of it, let's just listen in on what he had to say and what was his overall message.
The purpose of this investigation is to determine what was supposed to happen in our elections and what did happen, to see what went well, as well as to see what might have gone badly. If things did go wrong, we will submit recommendations for how problems should be addressed so that voters can have complete confidence in all of our elections going forward. We are not challenging the results of the 2020 election. Rather, we are holding government officials accountable to the public for their actions surrounding the elections. My job as special counsel is to gather all relevant information. And while I will draw my own conclusions, my goal is to put everything I know and everything I learn before you, the citizen, so that you can make up your own mind. I think it's very important, it's critical to know that an obstruction of this office is an obstruction of each citizen's right to know whether all ballots were appropriately counted, that our elections were managed with fairness, inclusivity, and accountability.
So, JR, we saw former Supreme Court Justice Gableman look right into the camera and kind of give a very strict warning, I guess, to election officials and county municipal clerks that if you don't participate in my investigation, I will issue subpoenas. So, very strong message. We knew that you know, he was going to hold people accountable, but he's also admitting that he's not really looking to overturn the election here. He's saying, I want to find you answers. I want to find the truth. So, we got a little bit of a tidbit here of what he wants to do. But still, there's no real action. I spoke to Milwaukee County Clerk again this week. He's like, sure, we'll participate, but we don't really know what he wants. We're very confused. Does he know the process? Last week, we talked about how clerks were criticizing him for not understanding the electoral process. So what did you really take away from this video?
He might have been watching last week's show, to be honest with you, because we talked about like all these issues with his investigation, right?
Right.
The stuff about who he's talking to, like talking to people who were maybe on the fringes of like what happened in 2020, right? Mm-hmm. He says, I'm going to go out and talk to people, and that it's incumbent upon the officials put on the election to prove it was done the up and up, which is kind of an interesting burden of proof. He talked about his subpoenas, and he tried to kind of address his criticisms of what he was doing. And I don't know if he put them to rest, but at least kind of get him on record about where he's at with stuff. Now, this video just popped up on YouTube on Monday. There's a line in the budget for his investigation to hire communication staff.
I haven't seen
the contract yet,
right,
for a communication,
right,
staffer, but it's popped up on YouTube. Robin Voss's office said that it did not have anything to do with production of this video. This was Gableman's thing at his office. What I'm kind of wondering, though, is like, okay, he's saying I'll subpoena you, and the burden proof is on you to prove it was done the up and up. How's that work, right? Because so far we've seen no concrete proof of a conspiracy election was quote-unquote stolen or anything else was missed. Now, as we said before, lawyers will debate ad nauseum about Elections Commission advice it gave about filling misinformation on absentee ballot envelopes. Was the definitely confined law about who can claim that status, was that maybe misused? Okay, maybe you can have the discussion. There's been nothing about machines, about ballots, about anything that's credible so far to say that there was something missed about this election. So where's he going with this?
Yeah.
And I still don't know, no matter what he finds, if he's going to make the people who are most adamant the election was stolen happy. Because he says in there, we're not about overturning the election results. Well, there are people who still believe that Donald Trump's going to be president again before the next couple of years are over, and he'll be reinstalled as president. And I'm not trying to mock him necessarily, but just like that idea is out there. And so if Gableman's saying, I'm not going to overturn the election with this, you're not making those folks happy. How do they react to whatever he finds?
He's asking also the public to come forward, clerks to prove that the election was run smoothly without any errors. Yet again, when it comes to asking the public, hey, I want to hear from everyone, he didn't really provide where people can contact his office or give their input, I guess, per se.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, all right, well, let's move on to our next topic, State of Education Address. It was Dr. Jill Underle, State Superintendent of Wisconsin, had her first address since taking the office. One of the big, I guess, no surprise here, right? Any of one of these speeches that I've seen that I'm sure you've listened to as well, is we want more funding for K-12 education. She specifically kind of bashed on Republican lawmakers for refusing to use the state surplus, right? There's a lot of rainy day funds in there. Republicans say we should keep those in a sense in case there's an emergency, right? Governor Evers even called them for a special session to use, you know, investments in education, all which were ignored. Of course, her request was immediately pushed back from Robin Voss, who said funding for K-12 in education is already at historic levels. And the Republican talking point that schools are receiving millions in federal funds to use towards a wide variety of things to help them recover from the pandemic. So kind of got this, once again, argument between Republicans, Democrats trying to boost education funding, but always running into roadblocks.
Well, the funding issue is interesting because Republicans define it differently than Democrats do, right? Republicans say you have to account for the federal funding and say how much schools are getting. Democrats say it's not fair to look at it because that COVID fund, those COVID funds are supposed to help with COVID expenses or challenges because of COVID.
And it's one-time federal funding.
One-time that runs out, I think, through 2023 or 4. You have to spend it by something like 3 or 4 years. It has to be spent
2024
by,
is the, I think,
all
going to
be gone.
Yeah.
And it's a reimbursement program where you have the expense, then you submit the expense to get reimbursed. They're saying that it shouldn't be counted in the overall pot of what's happening. Republicans say you can't ignore that money. Milwaukee got $900 million. How do you ignore that kind of money on top of what they're getting from state funds? So it's a perpetual discussion. Look, Jill Underle is not going to persuade Republicans to think differently about education. They're also not going to necessarily give her any wins on education or pay attention to what she has to say because they want to drive the train education with what you're seeing in the assembly floor next week, right? Bills about, they don't say critical race theory, but they're about critical race theory, about education. Curriculum becomes a gender identity. They're trying to dictate right now education policy. Evers is going to veto it, but you're seeing the Republican priorities when it comes to education right now, a little bit in the assembly calendar for Tuesday.
Let's take a listen from Jill Underle's speech.
Here's the commitment I want to make to you all today. Let's use the collective knowledge of the Department of Public Instruction and other leaders to strengthen not only civics, but social studies in general. Instead of acting unilaterally in the most uncivil way, let's bring stakeholders together. And let's confer with teachers, parents, and employers. Let's look at the riches that Wisconsin has to offer in both local and state history, historical sites, and movements. Let's utilize our assets that exist with the Wisconsin Historical Society, the Educational Communications Board, and the university system to craft resources and materials to support this learning available to educators and students at no cost. As the leader of the state public education system, this process is what I know would be best for our state, and this process is how I will lead. It's on us, the adults who benefited from public schools that were once the envy of every other state, to secure that legacy for future generations. It's on us to live our values and ensure the opportunities that public education affords are truly available to all children. We cannot afford to let this moment pass. We must invest in our school funding, in our children's opportunities, in the trust we show our teachers. It is our public schools that are the backbone of our democracy. And for democracy and civility to thrive, we need our public schools. Our economy needs our public schools. Our families and communities need our public schools. But most of all, our future, our children, need our public schools.
Underle also made a point during her speech that how a lot of school districts are forced to go through referendum to raise funds for things they need just because of what they say is a lack of funding resources over the years and these calls for revamping the formula. So nothing really new there with the calls. But with the pandemic, I mean, it does put schools in a lot of difficult different situations and having to pay for a lot more things. Speaking of back to school, I'm kind of phrasing next week's session. The Assembly and Senate will be on the floor on Tuesday. Not quite sure what the Senate is going to do, but the Assembly calendar looks a lot like a back-to-school legislation that they are going to be voting on. We'll first start with critical race theory. I covered this informal hearing. We're seeing a lot of these informal hearings to kind of have lawmakers get the opportunity to learn more about the topic. This specifically invited experts from across the United States, professors. The main three professors there were from the UW system. The big debate was lawmakers kind of hammering these professors and saying, are you teaching critical race theory? Let's both hear from both sides of the issue before we kind of dive deep into what each had to say.
The difference is that critical race theorists present their ideas not as one competing perspective among many, but as a truth, or as a, not even a truth, as a political necessity. Many professors inspired by critical race theory, critical pedagogy, are now treating the academic environment not as a protected space to search for truth, but as a protected space to push political activism. I support, for example, and I think you would all support, a professor's First Amendment right to express his or her own opinion. But the public is not entitled to subsidize that opinion with lifetime employment, with a cushy office and a salary, and a platform from a publicly financed and publicly chartered university system.
As a professor with 15 years of teaching and research experience in ethnic studies, I can truly say that CRT is not being taught at the undergraduate level. This is not because CRT is a fringe idea and not valid, but rather it is too advanced for students at that stage in their academic careers. And being that I teach an overwhelmingly white student body from small rural areas, I can affirm that students' interest in these topics and understanding these topics is very, very important. My goal is to provide them with the most accurate information and allow them to decide for themselves. Our students need to have these conversations and develop critical thinking and communication skills, cultural awareness, and a better understanding of power dynamics. Banning nuanced discussions of systemic racism, in my eyes, would be indoctrinating.
As we just heard from Professor King, he said we're not teaching critical race theory in undergraduate schools. He later added that he, you know, there might be those discussions in graduate courses when you're in law school, when you can have these debates about it. But lawmakers were even asking about K through 12 education. These professors didn't really know because there's this tough line of what's considered critical race theory. Lawmakers are struggling to define critical race theory. Some Republicans I talked to are concerned there might be some legal concerns down the road because of the terms are so vague. And it's also important to point out the assembly bill that's seeking to ban critical race theory doesn't even actually say critical race theory in the legislation at all. So there's this debate. Republicans want to know what's being taught in the classroom, but also on the other side, Democrats believe these are very important conversations to be having with any school age kid.
Look, there's a big talking point among Republicans about critical race theory, mask mandates. They're seeing energy with the conservative base right now that's leading to recalls of school board members, confrontations at school board meetings, a real energy out there. They see that and say we can harness that for 2022, keep that passion alive. It's part of why you're seeing this. Now, also interesting during public hearing this week about some of these education bills, argument from Republicans of we don't want educators to dictate what's happening in classrooms. We want parents setting the policy. Now, there's interesting debate there about what's the role of educators in terms of setting a curriculum versus parents and how much control should parents have. But you're seeing bills about transparency in the classroom, you know, what's going on.
Posting curriculum online.
How much schools are spending and on what, their budgets being posted online. So you see it. There's definitely an effort to try and capture that passion among the base right now about schools and what's going on in my kids' classroom.
Also, there was a new piece of legislation very quickly written, I would say. It came out last Friday. It was already had a public hearing. It's being sponsored by Representative John Plummer of Lodi. It would be 100. He's asking, I guess, in a sense, for Governor Evers, since he's the sole power over federal funds, asking Governor Evers to invest $100 million into mental health resources at schools. But in that bill, it also would give Joint Finance Committee more control over federal funds, which is something that's been ongoing throughout the summer. The Republicans say, hey, let's increase transparency. We should know how these funds are being spent. But the governor's not going to cave, and he's definitely going to veto the legislation.
Evers' office has said that he's allocated all the money already. Also pointed out he wanted to put $90 million, I think it was, in general purpose revenue, state tax dollars, into mental health programs. Probably going to cut that back to, I think, $19 million. So they're saying, look, we have plenty of general purpose revenue. Why don't you use that if you want to do these programs? But they want to try and get another thumb in the ARPA money, if you will.
All right, we'll move on to the COVID-19 update. Before we get to some updates about some lawmakers' diagnosis and transfers, I guess, on the path to recovery, state health officials are stressing once again that this Delta variant has not yet peaked. There's been national stories that it is peaking in other states. Therefore, cases are going to start leveling out. Wisconsin just says, you know, health officials say we're just not quite there yet. So let's take a listen to what they had to say about that.
What we'd have to say looking at the trend lines on our new positive cases is we are not at a plateau yet. We are not at a leveling off. We are still seeing a concerning rate of growth. The challenge that I would offer all of us is the fastest way to get to that plateau and eventually a downward trend in new cases is to follow the steps that we know work, to get vaccinated, to wear masks, to maintain physical distancing, to stay home when we feel sick.
Right now, we're about half as bad as we were during our surge in November to January last year. And no one knows. We have not seen a turning of the corner. We've seen some states in the southern United States have the same pattern as India, where their Delta surge was more severe in terms of more cases per day and more deaths than they saw in 2020 in the winter. We wanted to do everything we can to not have that happen in Wisconsin, but we've not seen anything reassuring that we're not headed in that direction right now.
So as health officials are warning of this highly contagious Delta variant, I guess maybe some good news that comes out of this. Over 142,000 people took advantage of Governor Evers' vaccine incentive program. They gave people $100 gift cards, but those people have to claim those gift cards. And if all of them do, I did the math, it's going to be costing the state over $14 million. But, you know, of course, Democrats, Governor Evers' administration just wants shots in arms, trying to get us over this hump, but I think we're staying around, we were just saying 52-53% of people fully vaccinated. Now, on the lawmaker front, we had two updates. First, candidate for governor, Republican Rebecca Clayfish, tested positive for COVID-19. Her campaign told us while she was on the trail. She posted a video just a day afterwards the news came out saying she's feeling fine, I'm feeling good. I even saw her tweet a little bit ago. Mm-hmm. She's going to be back on the campaign trail in a few days. On the other hand, we finally got an update first from State Senator Andre Jock's office that he left the hospital after being on a ventilator for over a month, I want to say, due to COVID-19 and was transferred to another facility. But it seems like it's going to be a long-haul recovery.
Yeah, and interestingly for Jock, I mean, obviously, number one, his health is the most important thing, having him recover. Next year is an election year. His seat is up. So there is kind of this question of, okay, what's his seat going to look like when redistricting is done? Is it going to be a swing seat, and how's he going to be able to campaign? Will he need help to campaign for that seat? Will it be a safe Republican seat? We'll all see. Again, very much secondary to his health and his recovery, but just something to keep in mind that there's a big year for him coming up in 2022, first re-election to state Senate seat.
And, of course, we'll see when he eventually emerges, because right now he's at another alternative care setting right now, just helping with breathing and some other things that he's working on. All right, JR, now's your turn for stock picks.
All right, so Dawn Krim rising. Look, there are several of Governor Evers' cabinet picks who have just been like basically at a standstill for weeks, months, just kind of hanging out there. All of a sudden, I know where Krim got a 5-0 vote out of committee and is moving. Now the question is, we see that Senate calendar for Tuesday. Is she on the calendar? but she joins Craig Thompson at Transportation, Missy Hughes at Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, Rainy Romanski at DATCAP, as Craig Thompson at Transportation, as cabinet members who have been voted out of committee on a unanimous vote. So now do they get to the floor and do they get done? What's interesting about that is, for a long time, Republicans kind of felt like, look, you know, they get to serve just in their seats no matter what. They don't lose any money in their paychecks. They don't have less authority doing this. Let's just let it lay. But there seems to be a sentiment now of, well, this might be bad precedent because someday you could have a Republican governor, Democratic state senate. They say, we're not going to confirm any of his or her appointments. So what's the point? Plus, it's all doing your job. The Senate process is you get nominations, you take them up and you vote them up or down. So for Dawn Krim, vote her up or down. It's time to make a decision about her. So it's a movement for Governor Evers on his cabinet picks. Now, don't expect those DNR board picks to go anywhere anytime soon. They're going to be bottled up for a while because their confirmations would flip the board from 4-3 Walker appointees mm-hmm. to 4-3 Evers appointees. But still some progress here on governor's cabinet picks.
And mixed is a new property tax proposal.
Personal property tax, like it's tax on businesses. Both sides want to hear this tax. It's how to do it and when's it going to get done. Remember, there was a bill this summer that Governor was vetoed because he had some concerns about language and unintended consequences. Fast forward to this week, and you have Democrats put out their own version of a personal property tax repeal that Governor supports. The problem is Republicans are going, okay, wait, we're not sure about the language in this bill. Also, there's a sentiment of why give Evers one more win
right.
within the tax break to sign after he signed $2 billion of tax breaks in the budget. We don't want to do that. We'll wait until 2023 and see if there's a Governor Evers or a Republican governor to work with us. And then if there's a Republican governor, get a bill more to our liking this one. One issue with this bill for Republicans is, so what happens is local governments levy a property tax on equipment like ovens for restaurants, for example. You take those off the rolls, that's lost revenue for local governments. The Republican bill would replace that money but keep that payment flat going forward. This bill would replace that money but then adjust that payment for CPI, consumer price index going forward. It'd be an ever-increasing payment off in the future. So that's just for Republicans as well.
And we got some new numbers from the UW system about enrollment, just a very 1% decline, but it's
1%,
down. 1%
is down. only up on three campuses. Madison up 6%, Green Bay 3%, I think Superior is 2%, something like that. But the key here is that it's a fall off from COVID. Kids didn't have a normal college experience last year, so there's less an enticement to go to college in person right now until the pandemic is over. So that's one of the reasons cited for the drop in enrollment. By the way, fewer kids means fewer tuition dollars, less money for UW, so just keep that in mind.
All right. Well, that will do it for this week. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Thanks for joining us.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.